I would like to, before I start, thank all these people here for helping me preparing this talk. And yeah, so thank you guys. Okay, so to give a kind of rough outline of the talk, I will start justifying why we spend time thinking about quantum information. Then I will try to give you an idea of how we try to bring into reality the things that we imagine. And finally, discuss a bit what we can learn for other areas of physics. Okay, so what is information? What is computation? I don't know how to answer that, so instead I will talk about smartphones. So, you know, smartphones are kind of the essential objects in our digital age. So in a smartphone you can store video, audio, any sort of data, in the future possibly even smells. So why is that? The underlying reason is that all information eventually refers to physical systems, okay? And with good approximation, they are classic. So as you know, every classical system is characterized by a phase space. We can effectively discretize and make finite such a phase space for a practical purpose. And then the states of a system can suddenly be characterized simply as strings of bits, right? Zeros and ones. The reason being that if I have n bits, I can address up to, or label up to the n different states. Okay, so this means that basically all physical systems are somehow interchangeable when it comes to information. I don't need, when I do information theory, I don't need to worry about the information carriers in that sense. Okay, and I have such a universal property. So another thing that your smartphone can do is compute. And if you forget about limitations in memory and, well, even the lifetime of the phone, essentially what you can compute in your smartphone, you can compute in any other computer. Okay, so there is, again, some sort of notion of universality, and this kind of class of machines is what we call a computer. Okay. So here comes Landauer to remind us that information is physical, and we know that physics is not classical, but quantum. But I said that we should not care about the carriers of information, so what's going on? Why should we worry? So to understand that the information that a quantum system carries is different from the information that a classical system carries, whatever that information is, let's consider a very simple setting. So I have some process where I have some quantum input, and I want to transform that quantum input into some classical signal, if you want, and then back into a quantum output. So this in the language of quantum mechanics, this means that I'm going to do a measurement, and then depending on the result of the measurement, I'm going to do some preparation. As it turns out, quantum mechanics tells us that no matter how you do this, you will never be able to have a process that is equivalent to doing nothing. Okay, so the measurements that I do in the output, their statistics, will never be the same as the ones that I would have gotten in the input. If we consider the converse process, where we go from classical to quantum to classical, there is really no problem. Okay, of course we do this every day when we encode classical information in quantum systems, which are the only ones that we have. So we see that there is some information that quantum systems carry that is qualitatively different from the information that a classical system can carry. Okay, and we are forced to move from bits to qubits. Okay, so these are two-level systems, and now we can have any, so to say, superposition of zeros and ones. Okay, so what is the new picture? Now I have my quantum systems. Well, this picture we already saw today. So we know that the pure states of a quantum systems are elements of a Hilbert space, and every Hilbert space can be embedded, finite Hilbert space, in a suitable tensor product of qubit Hilbert spaces, right? So these are our new strings of information, now strings of qubits. And again, we have this kind of universality of the notion of information. So the role of quantum information and computation, or the goal, is to study information and computational tasks that are carried with quantum systems, okay? And then find out, you know, how is that an advantage over the classical case? How is it different? Why it is different? And we already have interesting answers for this question. For example, in cryptography, the art of preserving secrets, we know that in a quantum world, we can preserve our secrets with the certainty that they cannot be uncovered, thanks to the laws of nature. Okay, thanks to quantum mechanics. So as long as it is correct, we are safe. Whereas in the classical case, we rely on the difficulty of a problem to be solved. Okay, so there is somehow no real guarantee of security there. So another thing that boosted a lot the interest in the subject was to understand that quantum computers can offer sometimes exponential speedups over in some task. Okay, so for example, in factoring integers, as is very famous. So this is probably the interest in integer factoring was because if we can do that, we can break the codes that the cryptographic protocols that are used nowadays to communicate. So of course, you know, government agencies would jump right away. Oh, I want to build a quantum computer, right? On the other hand, you know, it's very difficult to find interesting quantum algorithms, and it's not so clear, you know, in what things is a quantum computer useful and whether, in fact, even is actually more powerful than a classical one. We don't even know that for sure, although we suspect it, of course. Okay, so to give you an idea of how we think in quantum information, our approach has these three characteristics. So first of all, the abstraction that I mentioned before, that all systems, in the end, can be put into a common language so that we can compare very different physical systems on the same footing. This also allows, you know, for example, because in the end, all we use is the formalism of quantum mechanics, and this is very, you know, the rules of the game are very clear. It is easy for, say, a computer scientist to enter and work into it. They don't really know to understand physics, just like quantum mechanics. And well, we tend to be very rigorous because of these very clear rules of the game. Right? Also, quantum information is very task-oriented. So usually, the goal is to show that some task that could involve computation, some sort of communication or cryptography, can be done or cannot be done. Okay. And not only we care about whether it can be done or not, but also how feasible it is, okay? So this means, you know, how many resources do I need to consume in order to do it? So resources will depend on the task and with what we consider to be difficult. So for example, in computation, generally you think that the difficulty, so your resources are computation time and the amount of memory that you need to compute, for example. In communication theory, maybe you have some noisy channels and you want to see how many times do I need to use this noisy channel to more or less get a clean channel effectively. So these are examples of resources that have a classical analog, right? A very direct classical analog. But there are also resources that are intrinsic to the quantum case only, as we will see. Okay, so maybe to put it more lightly, what our perspective is in quantum information, consider the Schrödinger cat. So when faced with such you know, unusual feature of quantum mechanics or an intuitive feature, we can start thinking, is the cat dead and alive in two different parallel universes and things like that? Or instead, we can ask with Deng Xiaoping, does it catch mice? Okay. So what I mean by this is that we are kind of practical-minded, and we see the unusual features of quantum mechanics as an opportunity, a way to, you know, a way to do things that would otherwise be impossible, without really caring much about what it means. But then, by doing this and by facing difficult problems, probably you can learn a lot about quantum mechanics. Okay. So to continue with this apology of quantum information, I should talk about quantum computers, which are kind of the holy grail of the subject. And to do this, I go back in time to 1981, when Feynman gave a talk with this title. So there he discussed a program to simulate physics with computers. Okay. So he said that he was interested in this program because, you know, he thought that maybe By thinking about simulating the universe, you could constrain physical laws. You should get an idea of what they should look like. But, you know, or maybe not, right? Because if we remember this thing that Sagan told us about Maxwell and this mechanical model, so yeah, in that time it was mechanical models, and now we have computers, so the universe is a computer, so we should be careful. But in any case, his conclusion was that you should not be able to simulate the universe or physical systems with classical computers. Okay, you needed something different, something that was made of quantum components, and that would be a quantum computer. So in any case, this problem of simulating quantum systems is very important. I would say that nowadays, you know, the advance in science and technology could be faster if we have access to good quantum simulations, right? So just think of material design or design of chemical compounds, or maybe closer to us, high temperature superconductivity or lattice gauge theory, okay? We just, right now, are not in good shape to do those things. And, you know, just imagine that you could sit in front of your computer, program your Hamiltonian, the observables that you want to measure, and voila, get the answer, and then play around with the parameters and so on, right? So if we have a quantum computer, we will get a great window into the quantum world. Okay, so now let's talk about where we are 33 years after this Feynman talk regarding this goal of getting a quantum computer. And to that, for a moment, let me go back in time, okay, to this Antikythera mechanism that was discovered in a shipwreck. It is like from 100 years before Christ. And it was a mechanism to compute in advance like astronomical events like eclipses and so on. And this would be a more modern version, right, an astronomical clock. So these are examples of analog computers, a physical system that simulates another physical system. So typically, your sort of model or simulator will have many parameters that you can tune. And by tuning them, what you do is you get the time evolution to mimic the time evolution of the system that you are interested in. Okay. So nowadays, we are actually in the era of, or the dawn of the era of analog quantum computers. So to give you an example, we have optical lattices, okay, where by using lasers, we create an effective potential like this for some neutral atoms, and then we can tune the on-site interactions between the atoms and the couplings for jumping from side to side. Okay. Moreover, it's possible to recover information about the system in such a neat way as by being able to see the atoms in a one-by-one basis. Okay, so this is, this is really neat. And in fact, there are proposals to implement lattice gauge theories in such systems, even on abelian ones. So anyway, something to stay tuned to. But we want more. We want a quantum computer. So what is a quantum computer? Quantum computer is a device where we can control qubits with as much precision as we want, basically. Okay? So the rules of the game are that we should be able to initialize our qubits individually, then perform so-called unitary gates on a few qubits at a time, and at the end, measure individually the qubits. Okay? So with such a thing, as I said before, we could do many things, not only like simulating quantum systems, but that also in a convenient way. Okay, so how do we build a quantum computer? So certainly we need qubits that are very well isolated from the environment and over which we have a high degree of control. Of course, isolation will not be perfect, so there will be decoherence due to interaction with the environment. And as for control, well, to start with, unitary gates are parameterized continuously, so they will never be perfect, and there is always going to be some form of imprecision. So errors accumulate, and we need error correction. Okay, so error correction, you can think of it as a way to extract entropy that is created during the computation. So how does it work? Okay, so the trick is that errors are not arbitrary. The way, so because nature is local, okay, the way the environment will interact with our qubits, it's not arbitrary, but rather errors will tend to be local. Okay, so it's more likely that a few qubits at a time will be perturbed than rather than many of them. Therefore, what we do is we take much more physical qubits than than the logical qubits that we want. Okay, and somehow encode our so-called logical qubits, okay, the qubits where we are going to compute, into collective degrees of freedom of the of these many qubits. So maybe, you know, to make it more intuitive, we can consider in particular topological error correction, where we visualize our qubits in some sort of lattice, and then the rules of the game are that if I take some operator that is somewhat local, okay, like this one, then it should not be able to read, with such an operator, you should not be able to get any information about the logical qubits. Okay? So this means that all the states that we use to compute are indistinguishable for such local operators. On the other hand, logical operations will need to read such an amount of qubits that is comparable to the size of the system. Okay, so the good news is that error correction works. So we know that mathematically, at least speaking, we can compute for arbitrary long time with arbitrary precision, arbitrary number of qubits, as long as the noise is low enough, is below a certain threshold. The bad news is that in practice, the threshold might be so small, that it's impossible to attain in practice with the experimental devices, or you might need so many qubits that, it is a long way from here to get there. But anyway, let's see where we are in the roadmap to build a quantum computer. So in this roadmap, the first thing you should be able to do is to operate on single physical qubits, then on several of them, and then to be able to perform measurements and, depending on them, control your qubits and so on. So this is where we are right now, okay? Several technologies, such as ion traps or superconducting circuits, and so on, are at this stage. And now, the next stage would be to actually do some error correction. So this means we implement a memory, okay, some logical qubit, whose lifetime is longer than the lifetime of any of the physical qubits that we are using to construct that logical qubit. So, I don't know. I guess all the steps are difficult, but this step looks particularly difficult if, from the point of view of a theoretician, at least. It looks like if you can do this, then you should be able to do the other steps. But it's not clear. Anyway, the thing is that we are at a moment where error correction is very important. So, from the theoretical point of view, the effort should be focused on trying to find error correction protocols that are very efficient, that require high thresholds, okay, and that don't require many qubits. fortunately, breakthroughs keep happening in the field. It's very lively. And just to highlight a recent result by Daniel, he showed that for very large computations with many qubits, it is possible to have the number of physical qubits asymptotically proportional to the number of logical qubits that you want to use. And indeed, this constant can be as close to one as you would like. OK, so error correction is kind of nice, but also it's a bit annoying. And can we do it differently? After all, in conventional computers, we don't really need error correction because, well, if something goes slightly wrong, then a bit of heat is dissipated, and that's it. Things get naturally corrected. So can we have something similar? Can we have a self-correcting quantum computer? So in the quantum case, we could distinguish two kinds of such self-correction. So first of all, we could consider robustness against the formations of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so the Hamiltonian of the system will never be what we intend it to be, but we would like the results nevertheless to be the same, okay, if it is close enough. So this can be achieved with suitable physical models as long as they have the following properties. So we should have a gap system and then some ground state degeneracy so that in these degenerated states we put our logical qubits, okay? And then the really important property is that all these states in the different states in this ground state subspace should be locally indistinguishable. So this is basically what I was saying before about topological codes, but now with some Hamiltonian. So this is actually what our friends in condensed matter would call topological ordered system, okay? And not only in principle would it be possible to have such a system as a memory, but also with the anions, these fractional charges that Sagan was mentioning, well, it's possible to actually compute vibrating them, only the topology matters, therefore we have this deformation robustness, and so on. This is, well, kind of nice, particularly theoretically. But then we need more. Because in reality, we also have to take into account that we are at finite temperature, and we need to be robust against thermal fluctuations. And unfortunately, two-dimensional topological order, which is so beautiful and so on, only exists at, properly speaking, at zero temperature. So it looks like we need something else, okay? So basically, in the classical case, you have that the free energy separates different sectors. So this could be a zero and a one, right? And in order to go from one to the other, you need to overcome some energy barrier. So we would like such a thing, that in order to go from one sector to a sector with a different logical information, we need to go through a free energy barrier that grows with the system. Is this possible? Okay. Well, maybe. So we know that in four dimensions, okay, four spatial dimensions, it is theoretically possible. So the trick then is that instead of having these point-like excitations, like the anions, in four dimensions, it's possible to have all the excitations flux-like. Okay? So now the energy of these fluxes is proportional to their length. And these, at any finite temperature, typically they will not fluctuate beyond certain sizes with respect to the system. And the trick is that as long as, you know, any of these fluxes doesn't get comparable to the system size, you will not go through this point. Okay, so it works nicely. Only problem is in 4D. And just to mention some result we have taken with collaborators, it is possible to actually make this into a full quantum computer with initialization and, you know, gates and measurements, all at finite temperature and without having to use any self-correction. Only problem is you need six dimensions of, or actually seven to make everything local. Okay, so then this is really like one of the main things I think about, like how could we go down to three dimensions? Okay, can we actually go down to three dimensions and have a self-correcting quantum computer or not? Okay, so now suppose, forget these problems, we're in the future, and we built a quantum computer. Or maybe we didn't. maybe actually this guy here claims that he built a quantum computer. And well, I'm sorry guys, we are Peter. So yeah, Peter is not very convinced. So what can Peter do? So of course, remember there is these problems such as the integral factoring, where at least you know, for as long as we know, there is no good classical algorithm to do it. So we can try, you know, to compute that in the computer, and it turns out that the answer is very easy to check, okay? Or it's reasonably easy to check. So we can use this kind of problems where the answer is easy to check to see if the quantum computer actually works, or at least if the guy found a classical way to compute these things. But more generally, you know, there is a very interesting kind of philosophical problem about quantum computers. So as you know, there are mathematical proofs, like the four color theorem, that depend on a classical computation. So a classical computation, in principle, is something that you can check. Okay. But in the quantum case, if we were to do such a thing, you know, the quantum computer is like a black box. So whatever happened there, we don't know. Okay. that's intrinsic. So how do we verify a quantum computation? How do we verify that a specific computation that we wanted to happen? And Daniel and Gas are working on that. So the idea is that as long as quantum mechanics works, Peter should be able to know with very high certainty that the computation that he intended actually happened. Okay? So let's hope that they have success with that very interesting project. Okay, so now I continue with what can we learn from quantum information. And for this, I will finally talk about entanglement, which is actually the central element of quantum information theory. So Sagan already told us about entanglement. Maybe this will be a bit different. So entanglement is a property of bipartite systems, okay, or multipartite in general. And we can consider these two situations. So in the first situation, this bipartite system is initially prepared, and then each part is sent one to Alice, one to Bob. In the second situation, Alice and Bob can talk on the phone, and each of them prepares their subsystem, right? So as it turns out, the states that you can get here are, some of them cannot be obtained this way, okay? And those states we say that are entangled. So as Sagan noted, this is like a very important example of an entangled state, a maximally entangled state of two qubits, the state. And the interesting thing about such a state is that you can use it to do things. Most importantly, maybe, you can use it to teleport. So if Alice and Bob have one of these states, now Alice can send a qubit to Bob without using any quantum channel, just with the phone, okay? But in the process, they will lose this state. So now entanglement becomes a resource. It's a resource, and we can measure it, okay? So for pure states, there's a canonical measure of entanglement, which is the von Neumann entropy of either of the two subsystems. And the interesting thing is that this entanglement entropy measures entanglement in units of these guys, okay? So whatever entanglement I have here, that number of these states will allow me to do the same things that I could do with this guy, okay? So as you can see, in this case, the theory of entanglement becomes very neat, and it is not surprising that it finds applications in other fields. So, well, Sagan already told us a bit about this, but okay, so what can we learn? What can entanglement tell us about many body systems? So the way this idea of entanglement entropy is applied in condensed matter is, okay, you subdivide your system, some region and the rest of the system, and then compute entanglement entropy and see how it scales with the size of this region. So different scaling laws will correspond to different physics. But more generally, you know, you could consider, even without any Hamiltonians underlying or anything, you could consider what entanglement or entanglement entropy can tell you about such many body states intrinsically. Okay, and this is what Isaac likes to do. So recently, he managed to show that for these topological states that I was mentioning before, so there is a bound on the how the dimension of such a space can grow that depends only on the topological entanglement entropy. Oh, sorry, yeah. So how the entanglement entropy scales for this kind of undistinguishable state. And this way he managed to obtain a bound for such a dimension like this, depending on system size and spatial dimension. And this can be interesting for error correction. Okay, so before I was saying that a big problem in current science is to simulate quantum systems, and we also have something to learn from entanglement for this task. Namely, so the Hilbert space of many body system is a huge place, okay? So if you know how the entanglement entropy behaves, what you can do is you can construct you can constrain yourself to some region and construct ansatz that directly satisfy kind of these constraints, okay? So this is the kind of philosophy behind the tensor network approach. And well, already so I can mention it, but anyway, so yeah, so Lucas and Giffrey recently managed to make an important advancement in this regard by being able to apply these techniques to describing the or characterizing the topological order in two-dimensional systems. Okay. So just to close, a very important lesson that quantum information and computation gives us is that in the end, information and computation are physical. Okay? And therefore, they depend on physical laws. And we are allowed to ask such questions as, what is the ultimate computer? Or what is the computational power of the universe, if you want? Okay? And pretty much this fits into the lines of research of Keith and Eduardo. So to mention the case of Keith, he's interested in the interplay of quantum field theories and quantum computers. So the idea would be, how can I simulate with a quantum computer a quantum field theory, or whether I can? And conversely, which quantum field theories are powerful enough to represent a quantum computer? So notice that this is kind of relevant because a quantum field theory that is as powerful as a quantum computer, you wouldn't expect to be able, you know, to compute classically, much less by hand. Okay, so just to wrap up, what is the purpose of quantum information? Well, the purpose of quantum information is to build a Python. So in a Python, you can download your favorite Schrödinger cat. You can, you have a huge selection of quantum applications from our store. And you can talk to your lover without the NSA or News of the World listening. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, you have this nice picture of the different level of realization of quantum computer. Mm. So we are kind of halfway there.
Yes.
I just wonder, can we make an extrapolation how long it takes to reach the last level? By looking at the previously, how many years take to go one higher levels? Whether there's some estimate here.
You never know, because think about the development of the transistor, no? But I don't know. My feeling is that really the most difficult thing is to start doing error correction, and that then it should be smooth. But if you listen to experimentalists, it's not like that. And then, people always say, it's like, oh, in the next 10 years, we'll get it. So yeah, I don't know, really. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, just on that point. A couple of months ago, we learned that you can keep a qubit stable for more than half an hour at room temperature. Is that relevant to your?
Well, the thing is that you have different kind of qubits with different kind of properties. So whether, maybe some qubits will be very good for computing, others for storage, or maybe for transmitting, information from one processor to another. So there, the difficulty is to put them together, to work together. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I myself, Well, I have a prejudice like for solid state, okay, because solid state is like so developed, like we have computers basically, right? So things like superconducting circuits and so on, if I know, I feel that if they could be developed just a bit more, maybe suddenly we could start scaling things massively and get things done just with that, but I don't know.
The other question I wanted to ask is why is the paradigm that you want to go after a computer made of qubits? You dealt with an analog quantum computer, and what's the big advantage over a digital quantum computer?
Well,
like the one you're aiming for.
Yeah, it's the same as in the classical case. So of course, analog computers.
Is it really the same? Because the world, as far as we know, is described by quantum field theory.
Yeah, okay, but the thing is that you need to discretize in order to be precise. So in the classical case.
Is that really true?
I believe so. I believe so. So
don't we digitize in order to?
So just if you look at the theory of error correction, the thing is that people actually thought that it was not going to be possible to do.
Yes.
Because they looked at the qubits and they have like continuous parameters, right? So they thought, I will never be able to correct a continuous thing because just thinking in terms of analog classical computers.
Right.
But then we found out that it is possible to actually sort of digitize the errors, right?
Mm.
And this is really a property of such finite systems. So in that sense.
So you think error correction would not be possible in an analog quantum computer?
Yeah, I guess so.
Why?
Because, I'm just guessing. Because actually, I'm not good with, kind of infinities. And I don't even believe infinities, okay? So, maybe we could ask somebody who knows more about it. But I believe that you would not be able to do. I mean, it must be analog to the classical.
Well, that would be interesting if one could show that it's somehow. I mean, error correction is always a relative thing. You need to correct it well enough that you.
Well, but if it is well enough, then you are probably back to a discrete scenario. So you could say also this of analog classical computers, right? So I mean, effectively, I say that I don't believe in infinities. I mean, what infinity do we have access to in real life? Before I was talking about discretizing classical. I mean, we only have access to discretized stuff. It's just that in our mind we imagine that there is something else. You know, but in the end, we just have a set of observables that we can measure, and that's all. That's a physical system.
We live in an infinite universe.
Still, it could be discrete.
Okay.
Who knows if infinite, right?
Are there any further questions?
Let me try to, if there are no others, I'll take advantage of having the microphone. And let me ask, maybe this is Neil's question in a more philosophical mode. You started with Landauer's principle that information is physical, but does that imply that physics is informational?
Yeah, there is this converse statement, right? Physics is information. What does it mean?
I don't know.
This is my question. Because
a lot of one hears people asserting that physics is information.
I don't know. I find it a bit of an empty. I don't really know what does it mean. I mean. What does it mean? I don't know. Second.
I don't know. If you are successful describing, say, elementary particle like a photon, electron, in terms of qubits only, and can we say that the matter is informational? Whether that could be one way.
Yes, but that's a bit empty. Yes, you can see that, but for me, that doesn't mean much.
Yeah,
it's personal. Yeah. I don't know.
So actually, I have another question. Is that you mentioned that there is a way to test what is a quantum computer?
Whether it would work? No. Well, I mentioned that they want to develop.
No.
Oh, sorry.
No. In one of your slides, you say there is a way to test whether a particular computer is a quantum computer or not quantum computer. Is that the right understanding?
We would like to have a way to test whether a quantum computer is actually working as a quantum computer. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then we know that there's a D-wave computer.
Yeah.
Is that the one passed your test?
Yeah, people yeah, in that case, they are having like real difficulties to differentiate what happens in that So, well, that's also like a simulator, right? From to differentiate it from the classical case, because basically it's a form of thermalization. So whether it has a quantum element or not, it's kind of difficult to tell. But yeah, so it's a scenario that is like completely different, because yeah, we are talking about really having a quantum computer where you can do anything, right?
Okay, so I think we should continue the discussion during the coffee break. So let's thank our speaker again.